A little later this month will mark the 95th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, the constitutional change that gave women the right to vote. Today, not only do they have the right to vote, more and more of them are being voted for on the state, local, and national levels. The history of the suffragette movement is fascinating, and with us to talk about that history and its consequences are Rebecca Now, historian and speaker whose day job is as executive director of the Webster Groves Shrewsbury Area Chamber of Commerce. Professor Yvette Joy Liebesman is associate professor of law at St. Louis University. Thank you, ladies, so much for being with us.
Thank you, Don.
It's a big week, a big month for the ladies of America, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what's going to be going on. This movement started long before ratification 95 years ago, and I'll start with you on that.
Well, I mark it from 1848. Yvette has a prequel to that, but 1848 is when the Women's Rights Convention convened in Seneca Falls, New York. At that time, there were a group that protested against a lot of laws that discriminated against women, particularly as it related to property rights. Married women could not own property. They had no legal right to their wages. If there was a divorce, they did not get the children. They automatically went to the male. This convention went one step further, and the writer for this was Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and she wrote A Declaration of Rights and Sentiments. And in that, she called for the right to vote, and that's considered the start of the modern women's rights movement.
Yvette, but you can take it back a little farther than that, is that right?
Yeah, a bit farther. Back in 1776, when we were declaring independence as a nation, the various states were told, okay, put together your constitutions, and because we're getting ready to gear up. And New Jersey, of all things, when they wrote about who had the right to vote, they wrote any person that has 50 pounds to their name, because we were still under English currency, and was over age 21 and had lived in the state and in the district for a certain number of years. And it was very open and broad, and it didn't actually say men. And then people were questioning this, and then when they came out with the first Voting Rights Act in New Jersey, the language specifically said he or she. So they had opened it up to women back in 1776, this right to vote. And you may think, wow, it's great that women can vote. But it was actually even limited there, because you had to have 50 pounds to your name. As Rebecca just said, married women own no property. So basically, if you were a widow or a spinster, you had the right to vote. And then in 1807, when I believe the Federalists took power in this country overall, they kind of didn't like the idea that women were voting. They felt they were all Republicans and that they wanted to strengthen their hold. And they said, well, how can we get around this constitutional challenge? Well, oh my goodness, there's voter fraud going on. Some married women are actually voting. Now, they had no proof of this, but they said, oh my goodness, there's voter fraud. We have to stop these married women from voting. And, well, looking at a woman, you don't want to be asking her, well, are you married or not? And you don't want to go through all that. So if we just get rid of this requirement that women can vote, then problem solved. And they also had issues that, if you notice the language, it also didn't just say white men could vote. It said anybody could vote. So you had freed African Americans also had the right to vote in New Jersey during this period of time. And what they ended up doing was saying, well, we're going to reinterpret the New Jersey Constitution. And when we mean people, what we really mean are white guys. Mm-hmm. And
well,
they changed it.
After all of that.
After all of that.
Well,
yeah.
I'm a native New Jerseyan, if you will.
And, so am
and,
I.
Are you really? Well, things haven't improved terribly much since, have they? Some of the things that go on in the state these days. Mm-hmm. You know, I seem to remember, correct me if I'm wrong, maybe as the historian you'll know, I seem to remember Abigail Adams being very active in this area and telling her husband that, you know, women need the right to vote when they were building that document that really founded our country.
I don't know much about the history of that other than the song from 1776 when she was – movie 1776 when she was requesting it. Maybe Rebecca knows a little more.
Evidently, she did write her husband. There's quite a bit of correspondence between the two, and she advised her husband quite a bit. She was respected by John Adams, and she had said to him, remember the ladies.
Remember the ladies. That's mm-hmm. exactly what I was thinking of. When did the movement really gain a full head of steam, Rebecca?
Well, it really launched with the Seneca Falls Convention, and there were women's rights conventions all over the Northeast after that. 3 years after that convention, Elizabeth Cady Stanton met Susan B. Anthony. Susan B. Anthony was working in temperance, and she was working in the abolition movement. It was Elizabeth that convinced her to work with her. The two of them became lifelong political partners. 50 years of their life, they spent together working on this project. And Elizabeth, by the way, had 7 children at the same time.
Not 7 children at the same time.
Well, no, but over her lifetime. I'm sorry. So they would travel around. They would do a lot of public speaking and convincing people, petitioning the New York State Legislature to change laws. And they were quite effective in getting some of them changed for property rights. They also founded an organization, the National Women's Suffrage Association, and that brought in, over time, thousands and thousands of women to their cause. Susan B. Anthony and both of them, Susan and Elizabeth, traveled coast to coast. And Wyoming was the first state to grant women the right to vote. And it came out of a woman who was in a speaking event with Susan. And she went back to Wyoming and convinced the people that were drawing up the state constitution that they needed to allow women too, because that would attract more women and get the place more settled, because Wyoming was just miners and cowboys at that time.
There were men involved in this process too, Yvette. Wasn't that true? The suffragette movement was not totally women.
Oh, it would never succeed otherwise, because women couldn't vote to give themselves suffrage. So yes, it was very much. And what's very interesting is that part of what's going on with the vote is also moving forward women's property rights, married women's property rights. And one of the biggest issues, one of the biggest, I hate to say it, things that pushed women's property rights in general forward was women being abandoned by their husbands. And a woman who was abandoned by her husband still couldn't enter into a contract, still couldn't have wages, still couldn't do a lot of things that you need to just to survive, and she would be at the mercy of the town for charity. Well, rather than, you know, constantly having these abandoned women in their families counting on the kindness of strangers, they said, well, let's just treat them like unmarried women. So you had a lot of what are called the Femsel Traitor Acts coming through. The first one there was in Pennsylvania in 1719 after William Penn's son abandoned his wife and children, and his stepmother convinced the Pennsylvania legislature to have these acts enacted so that way women, married women who were abandoned by their husbands, could then enter into contracts and move forward with their lives and not be a burden on society. And that was the impetus for growing women's property, married women's property rights in this country, was first because of kind of sleazy husbands.
Rebecca, what would the opposition have been saying when during the marches and during any presentations that were being made, those that were opposed to women?
Well, the thing in the early 19th century, when the mass media was really preachers in pulpits, they were admonished to stay silent and submit to their husbands. So the whole idea of even a woman speaking in front of a mixed audience, and mixed meant men and women in the same room, that alone was a huge hurdle to get over. Then, as late as 1915, with the New York Times, New York Times in 1950 wrote an editorial and said, "The grant of suffrage to women is repugnant to the instincts that strike their roots deep in the order of nature. It runs counter to human reason. It flouts the teaching of experience and the admonitions of common sense." 1915.
What do you think of that? Of that?
That was a very long time ago. And unfortunately, we hear a lot of the same rhetoric. Unfortunately, we've been hearing a little bit now, and you know, the beauty of the internet is that we hear all voices. And unfortunately, we still hear some outliers like that today.
We do hear all voices unfiltered. We have a tweet here. Speaking as we get to this part of our discussion, very interesting. The writer says, "Women didn't win the vote 95 years ago. White women did. Please keep this fact in today's discussion." And she also notes that we can also touch upon the fact that many suffragettes were notorious racists. Does that ring true to you?
It is a bit. There was a march on Washington the day before Woodrow Wilson was inaugurated in 1913. And the suffragists do not have a politically correct record on African-American women. They did allow them to march in the parade, but they wanted them in a segregated unit, and that was because they didn't want to offend Southern white women. However, Ida B. Wells jumped right in. She wasn't going to wait for the African-American unit. And it's true, that's not an exactly wonderful history on that issue, but we all have it now.
Yeah. And it was a product of the times, and that was 100 years ago. But the tweeter is absolutely right, that this was about white women getting the vote, and that I could, you know, just imagine the horrors that would have happened to any African-American women who had been arrested and jailed along with these women. Mm-hmm. That was a product of the times. They weren't perfect by any stretch of the imagination. They moved the ball forward. Did they move it forward as much as everyone would have liked them to? No. We're still moving that ball forward. We haven't stopped. Sometimes we move the ball backwards, unfortunately. And I think that's one of the biggest lessons we look in history when we see all these things and we look at the history, that just because we had rights doesn't mean we can't lose them. And for every time we move the ball forward, somebody is moving it back again, and we just have to keep pushing it forward. And maybe we're not moving. And these women, maybe they could have done more. I wasn't around 100 years ago. I don't know what the conditions were, but the Twitterer is absolutely right. It was for white women. Right. And we shouldn't. She's absolutely right, too, that we shouldn't lose sight of that either.
Rebecca, were arrests and jailings commonplace? Did this happen more often than not?
Well, at the beginning of the 20th century, the movement had really fallen into the doldrums. And it was the march in 1913 prior to Woodrow Wilson's inauguration, where there was a near riot that broke out when 5,000 women marched in the streets of Washington, D.C. No one was jailed at that time. But in the movement, there became a split. And Carrie Catt was the inherited the mantle from Susan B. Anthony running the National American Women's Suffrage Association. And Alice Paul had been in Great Britain and learned from some of the militants and civilly disobedient women in London. And she had a different approach. And that's what led to the arrests. And Alice Paul, it's amazing that she is not more well known in American history. She decided that she would have silent sentinels. And she was the first to be civilly disobedient with placards. And the women sewed banners on cloth that said, "Mr. President, when will you support women's suffrage?" And they said some things that really offended him. At one time, the Russian envoy from the new Russian government after the Russian Revolution was coming to the United States, and they wrote a banner that said, "Don't let Wilson tell you we have democracy here, because we don't have democracy for 20 million American women." So after the war started in 1917, World War I, people expected the women to fold up shop and stop the picketing. But Alice Paul refused, because the Civil War, she remembered what happened to Susan and Elizabeth after the Civil War, and she said, "No, we're not stopping." And that's when the arrests started. And it was basically rowdy people that were heckling them, pushing them, ripping up their banners. And who got arrested? The suffragists got arrested. And they were thrown into a Virginia workhouse. They were beaten. They went on a hunger strike. And then Alice Paul was force-fed. And the resulting publicity from all of this turned the tide. And the nation was suddenly behind the women. And Wilson was tired of it. And after a year of protests, he finally came out and in 1918 in favor of women's suffrage.
Finally, in 1918. Yvette, what about, Rebecca brought up the London part of this. What about the international component to the story? Because this was going on in many countries around mm-hmm. the world, wasn't it? How is that affecting what was going on here?
I'll let Rebecca take that one.
I will say that the Russian Revolution gave Russian women the vote. In 1918, Canada gave women the vote. And then in 1917, New York State gave women the vote, which I have to believe the confluence of those three places really affected our legislatures in thinking that this is an idea whose time is coming sooner than they wanted it. But New York State was huge. We'd gotten a lot of states in the West, Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, California. But to get New York State with all those electoral votes, the men had to stand up and take notice.
However, it's also should be noted that not every European country or every country that was granting women the right to vote right after World War I. It took Switzerland until 1971 to give women the right to vote. So it wasn't this grand worldwide push amongst industrial nations, our, quote, allies. Switzerland, 1971.
Incredible. What was the conversation, the debate like in Congress as Congress was getting into this whole thing?
Well, I don't have all the quotes from them, but many of them would pontificate on a woman wants to be at home. She doesn't want to soil her hands with the dirt and the fights of politics.
The hand that rocks the cradle.
Yes, exactly.
She doesn't need the vote. She raises our sons.
She raises our sons. That was the gist of most of their arguments, I think.
Or women really don't know what they want, and they'll only be voting what their husbands want, and they'll regret having the vote. Think of a lot of the arguments that anti-choice people make about women, thinking they know what their minds. And instead of using those words, you replace it with suffrage.
It reminds me of the debate during the Equal Rights Amendment.
Exactly.
It's really the same. It's the same kind of thing.
Yep.
Now, my impression is from some of the notes that I have that there was one vote separated a major decision in this. One vote was that?
My goodness gracious. This is amazing.
Harry Byrne.
Oh, this is a great story. And my favorite story about the whole 19th Amendment. When it finally passed Congress by both houses, it had to be ratified by 36 of the 48 United States that we had at that period in time. And the army of Kerry Catt, which was 2 million suffragists and 50,000 from the National Women's Party, had fanned out across every state to get it ratified. They had 35 states ratified by 1920. It's August 1920, they're all in Nashville, Tennessee, trying to get the 36th state. And everybody was lobbying the legislatures, the antis, the pro-suffrage. In the legislature, all the men, because it was 100% men, wore a red rose in their lapel if they were against the amendment and a yellow rose if they were for it. A quick count of the room showed you that the red roses were going to win and it was not going to pass. At the very last moment, a young man, 24 years old, from Eastern Tennessee, changed his vote. He was wearing a red rose, and he voted aye, making it pass. And he had a letter in his pocket from his mother that said, Harry, do the right thing. Put the rat in ratification for Mrs. Catt. And that's how we got the vote.
You know, there were so many important votes in this country that were decided by one vote. The one that immediately comes to mind is our national symbol might have been the turkey rather than the eagle. And that was decided by one vote.
I
think our draft was decided by one vote, too. Is that
I believe amazing. I believe President Andrew Johnson avoided impeachment by one vote.
Right.
Yeah.
Incredible. Yvette, was there anything like this before in our country in terms of so many people out on the streets picketing and marching for a particular cause?
I've seen that a lot the Civil War had a lot of draft pickets and a lot of draft riots because the wealthy were able to buy substitutes for their drafts. It's you don't get noticed quite, as we've seen many, many times, quiet protests don't get noticed and they don't get at cause action. Mm-hmm. And there's always been the call, well, do they really have to do that? Did they really have to protest? Did they really have to go violent? And things like that. But it seems every time we've had major change in this country, it's because it got noticed. And how does it get noticed? It gets noticed because people don't act, as we'll say, politely. They somehow are acting in a way that the people in power, the people, the quote, polite society says, oh, my goodness, they're not being polite. But that's when things get noticed and that's when change happens. And that's happened time and time again. There's countless examples through our history.
Sure. Well, we only have about a minute left. And I'll ask you, Rebecca, what do you think Elizabeth Stanton and Susan B. Anthony would think today if they look at our Senate with 20 female members and look at two candidates running for president who are female?
Not enough.
That was you, Beth. I think they would be proud of the people they trained and what happened in 1920. I think they would be excited about the possibilities and also frustrated that only 20% of our Congress is there. And I just have to say, Don, this is to me that the ratification day, which is tomorrow, tomorrow's the 95th anniversary.
Tomorrow is
the day that Harry Byrne in Nashville, Tennessee. The 26th is actually when it was signed by the Secretary of State. It's not celebrated, and I'm celebrating it tomorrow night in Webster Groves.
I know you are. Tell me about that in 15 seconds.
All right. Tomorrow night at Llewellyn's in Webster Groves, we're doing a Celebrate the Vote event, and we're doing a short lightning history. We have singers. We have a lot of scrumptious appetizers. And it's going to be a great way to toast the thousands, no, millions of suffragettes who made this happen. And we as a nation should celebrate
it. Tomorrow at 5 at Llewellyn's in Webster Grove. I want to thank you ladies so much for being with us. Yvette Liebesman, thank you for being with me. And Rebecca Now, nice to see you again.
Thank you so much.
Hope you have a great evening tomorrow. And tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with St. Louis writer Sarah Kendzior about her book of essays covering local and national news, the problems of academia, and criticism of the press. We'll also take a look at talk with a local archaeologist about some findings downtown. Archive versions of St. Louis on the Air available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.